What goes on behind the scenes in Pacific politics and how does it affect us? Each week, Politalk dives straight into the tough questions. Like what happens if a World War II shipwreck ruptures and unleashes thousands of liters of oil into our ocean?
Across the Pacific, there's around 3,800 of these World War II shipwrecks which are potentially polluting.
On Politalk, Tuesdays, 9 a.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is an ABC podcast.
Eka moe o Montalohani, Nissan Bolivinaka, Malonelein. Good morning. This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. I'm your host, Aggie Dubois, and yes, I am back for 2026. I've had a well-deserved break, and I just want to say massive thank you to my team for looking after the show and continuing to bring you the latest news from across the region. I do hope, though, that you had a great Christmas and wishing you a very fruitful new year, and thank you for being a loyal Pacific Beat listener. Well, today on the show, there is a controversial billboard campaign happening in Guam. Will a free needle and syringe program help curb the rise of HIV in Fiji? And who doesn't love some good old-fashioned belly laughs? Well, I caught up with well-known Kiwi Samoan comedian Tofinga as he prepares for one of his funniest shows to date. More on that shortly, but as always, let me acknowledge that our show comes to you from the lands of the Bunurong and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation. So, obrigada. Thank you for tuning into Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific. Firstly, politicians in Guam and CNMI have asked for a deadline of January 12th on deep-sea mining consultations to be pushed, warning local communities don't have enough information to take part meaningfully. The request comes amid renewed pressure from Washington following executive declarations by US President Donald Trump aimed at accelerating seabed mining. Federal ocean agencies are planning to lease more than 35 million acres of ocean floor for mineral extraction, including areas near the Mariana Trench, one of the most fragile and least understood ecosystems on the planet. Now, reporter Jordan Fennell spoke with Micronesian Conservation Coalition Executive Director Julie Hartop, who is urging people to speak up.
Julie, politicians from both Guam and CNMI, they've come out to ask for a push of a deadline for comments about this proposal for deep sea mining. They say local communities don't have enough information to take part in these consultations. What are you seeing on the ground about this?
I 100% agree. I mean, even as a scientist, working with some of the different environmental concerns in the region, we don't have enough information, and I don't think there's been enough information or research done prior to actually answer questions that probably the community is going to have and that I have as a scientist as well. So, also this extending of this comment was done over Christmas, so we're all wanting to be with our families, and culturally it is, we're very family and community centric culture here. And so that wasn't taken into consideration. And so I think on both sides, this is 100% accurate that our governors are very in touch with the people and the communities, and we want to know more information.
And on that information, what do you think is sort of like the key information that communities and scientists like yourself would like to see to be able to give feedback and give those consultations about this proposal for deep sea mining?
Well, I want to see the back research for it. So, what are going to be what are the short term and long term effects and or implications, and how might that affect us long term? It seems like with the administration that's been in office, there seems to be this very quick to action without really knowing what the cause or what's going to be the fallout. And it actually then really falls on individual people that that are then taxed with all of this, either, you know, so how does this affect the microbial health of our ocean in this region? Not just overall, but, you know, for our region where we are very dependent on it as a food source. So I think those things need to be addressed. Where is that research? Can you give us guarantees? You know, I don't, you know, what is this new technology that's going to be used? And has it been fully tested? Or are we, get again, in this region, going to be the testing area for things?
The U.S. federal ocean agencies are planning to lease more than 35 million acres of ocean floor for this mineral extraction. What concerns do you have about this?
I have so many concerns. So I think for me, the biggest one has been, what is this going to do to the microbial health of the ocean? And it's a very kind of, even for me as a scientist, because it's not my area of study, but, you know, you're given kind of these, you know, understanding of these cycles that happen in the ocean, you know, when you go through your studies, and it's all kind of interconnected. And as I mentioned before, I look as the ocean as like the blood of the earth. And that's because you have, you know, these microbials, like from bacteria and viruses, that do this like carbon cycle that allow air that have like go down to the deep, you know, decaying matter down at the, it all is a recyclable, beautiful cycle that happens that really brings life to Earth. It brings, you know, the air we breathe. It, you know, interacts with the atmosphere. And so, you know, we really, you know, I've heard this so many times going through school, that we know more about, you know, outer space than we do about our deep sea. But yet now we're going to go down and we're going to just mine this whole area without knowing anything about it. And yet we have such reliance on this, you know, is it so, you know, if we go and we remove that, how does that affect that cycle?
And have you submitted any feedback? And what did you say?
We are getting ready to. So we are ones that we have been working on a document that we will be submitting as an organization to our concerns and things that need to be addressed. Yes. You know, when I sat down thinking about it and was like, of course, one of my concerns was our reef manta ray. We have a critically endangered number here on Guam. It is one of the, it's what I'm doing my research on. And you have like, we have a tiny, tiny population and we have tons of reef sightings, which tells you that whatever habitat they're using is very important and that you have this adult survival ship. But if you remove any of that, then even I was doing the statistics on it, removing, you know, 20% of that, if something were to happen, 20% of that number. And for Guam, it's 65 individuals. That's it. So 20% are affected in any way that these adults are removed, the population begins to crash. And so, you know, those types of things, you know, we need to know what are these specifics, you know, that yes, maybe reef manta rays aren't endangered for the U.S. as a whole, but for Guam, they are, you know, for our area where you're wanting to do this type of mining. And our mantas are different. Our mantas don't use the reef as much. Their more percentage of their time is spent at depth, or spent at these deeper depths. So you're looking at between 250 to 500 meters that they spend a lot of their time.
Last year, a similar situation in American Samoa played out when it came to submitting feedback on the proposal. that territory submitted approximately 76,000 comments during its comment period, and roughly 98% opposed a similar deep sea mining proposal. Despite that overwhelming public opposition, the U.S. Federal Ocean Agency announced it was still going to move forward with its environmental review for the deep sea mining. How does that make you feel about the situation facing Guam and CNMI?
I mean, I think, unfortunately, we've had to deal with this historically for a very, very long time, you know, that we have concerns about environmental of land or different ocean use. And it's just not listened to. It's not, we're probably going to see the same scenario happen that we saw in America Samoa. So it's disheartening, you know, because you would hope that people would see, like, the health of the ocean, even though it's right here in our backyard, really affects everyone. The ocean is the blood, you know, and so it circulates around. And so there needs to be this universal concern about ocean health. But there's always this drive of, like, what can we get from it? And individuals or companies or even countries where it doesn't matter as long as it looks, you know, they get the money for that time. Honestly, it's disheartening.
And that there is Micronesian Conservation Coalition Executive Director Julie Hartoff speaking there. Well, staying with Guam, we head to the Attorney General, who's launched a controversial new campaign with a billboard showing a shackled cartoon person clutching a passport and luggage stamped with the word purged. Now, Attorney General Douglas Moylan says the campaign is part of a crackdown on crime, working closely with US Immigration and Customs Enforcement to remove non-citizen offenders from the island and, in some cases, allowing early release from prison in exchange for leaving Guam. But it's sparked backlash, with critics accusing his office of fear-mongering, public shaming and racial targeting. Well, we've got on the line Guam's Attorney General Douglas Moylan, who joins me this morning. With that, I say half a day, Attorney General.
Half a day.
Yeah.
Hi, Aggie, right?
Yes.
Hi, Aggie. This is Doug Moylan from the U.S. Territory of Guam, saying hello to your Australian citizens and people there.
Thank you very much for joining us this morning, Attorney General. Look, let's get straight into it. Obviously, this billboard campaign seems to have, caused a little bit of what they say, fear-mongering, public shaming. Yeah.
Controversy.
Controversy, of course. But, you know, when we see something like, and I have seen the picture, it is in front of me right now, I'm wondering, what outcome were you trying to achieve with this imagery?
You know, as an attorney for the people of Guam, I was elected by them in 2022. As an attorney, my primary responsibility is ensuring the health and safety of our community here. And since I took office, and the reason why I'm in office, was a perception of our community that too much crime was occurring on Guam, this U.S. territory. So having lived here all my life and been an attorney for 33 years, we targeted what exactly are the problems. Repeat offenders and meth addicts, many of them, whom are not U.S. citizens. So going to our U.S. Constitution and the right to be an American citizen, same thing with the Australian citizens, I would presume. You have a bundle of rights, and one of the rights that we have here is the right to live in peace and to have happiness and safety. We call it the Due Process Clause, life, liberty, property, that guarantee. These immigrants were allowed by the federal government, the U.S. federal government, to come into Guam under certain qualifications, as well as the United States, the mainland. And they breached that commitment that their country made to Guam. Now, we're just talking one of them. Our program is broad-based. It's any non-U.S. citizen that breaks our laws. They are subject to removal. And this isn't just the territorial government. This is the federal government. They call it the Department of Homeland Security, ICE, that would come in and remove them. They issue detainers. So we're really promoting a federal program, and it's ensuring the safety of our community. And, you know, with all the what they call woke in the United States, these people that are unrealistic in their perceptions I call them socialist communists. They've got to realize that, you know, being in the United States, we do not tolerate people that hurt us. And that's what it comes down to. It's the crime victims on Guam. We're experiencing the full range of violent crimes, from murder, rape, robbery, assault, family violence, thefts, thefts in the nonviolent area, of course. But that is the primary duty of the chief law enforcement officer on Guam, is to, in which is the position I hold for 4 years, to clean up this island, make sure that when we have our visitors, of which we depend upon, one half of our economy is the tourism industry, as well as the other part is the military spending, is the idea that when tourists look at an area, they want to make sure that they're not being mugged or robbed or hurt. In, I think it was 2024, we literally had a Korean tourist that came into Guam. It was a nuclear physicist that was retiring. His family sent him to Guam, and a meth addict had killed that person. Now, of course, that was a U.S. citizen. But the idea that when a perception in a community is that tourists are their lives are in jeopardy, that is where I come in as the attorney general. So a segment of the community is non-U.S. It is a large segment of the community, in my opinion. We look to the courts. The court dockets are filled with non-U.S. citizens that are being arrested for the full spectrum of crimes. So, yeah, that, you know, whether it's controversial, whether it's not politically correct, not culturally correct, I really don't care as an attorney general. This is my home. We want a safe home here, especially for the people that are trying to live their lives and be happy.
Mm. It's really interesting, Attorney General, you know, with this obviously follows on from even what you have on your website, right? You've got pictures of people who you claim to be criminals with nicknames like Methamphetamine or Buzz Lightyear written across what looks right. like, what sort of looks like mugshots, right? So along with that, I mean, what have they been charged with? Because I'm trying to understand, have these people Absolutely. Actually been convicted of crimes?
Yes, they have. And see, that's the difference. When you live in the United States, you're innocent till proven guilty. And these people that we're showcasing, and we're using the cultural type of allusions to it to just to, how do we say, deter. I've got a program since I started in 2023. It uses these billboards to bring up the issues every month that I feel are relevant to my client. And also primarily geared towards deterrence, putting people's faces up there that have committed crimes, that have been convicted by our criminal justice system, and that is trying to motivate them, because Guam is a small community, about 150 to 170,000 people here. The families are very strong. So when U.S. citizens, and this includes U.S. citizens as well, when the residents of Guam see a family member up there, it creates a social pressure on them to not commit crime again, to not do that crime, because these are the consequences. And it goes along that idea of deterrence. So for the non-U.S. citizens, every photo that you're seeing, it's on our website. It's also on social media, Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, you name it, we're on it. The idea is to send out the message to those non-U.S. citizens. You break our laws. You violate your privilege here to be a guest in our community. And this attorney general and our law enforcement community will arrest, will work with our Department of Homeland Security and our courts to convict you. And as I said, ICE and Department of Homeland Security will deport them. They issue detainers before they can get out of prison. They literally are turned over to the federal ICE officers, and they get deported. We also have a local program to allow people that won't be deported by ICE to have the opportunity, and these are the defendants and their defense counsels, to actually leave Guam. And then we issue a bench warrant and put it in the federal system database that if they try to show up again, they'll be taken right to our prisons. In the federal system, if you show up, you're going to be taken to a federal court and, you know, either denied entry, or if you get through their system, you'll be prosecuted in the federal courts. So, you know, it's just the idea of maintaining the integrity of what it is to be in a safe community.
I know that also with this purge campaign, you know, you said in a press release that your office is tactically, right, prosecuting and creatively settling cases to really remove people quickly. I mean, what does that mean in practice, though, or in reality?
It means a safer community. It means less crime victims. It means less pain and suffering. And I guess from an older person's perspective, that's what it comes down to, the quality of life. If it, and in our lifetime, I'm an attorney, so I know how the legal processes can take years, decades to get through. But in the criminal processes, they move quicker than the civil processes through our courts. And the idea is to take the problem, identify it, convict these individuals, protect the crime victim, and get them out of here. We have too many problems in our own local community with our existing U.S. citizens to have to deal with and not deal with these immigrants. And by the way, the biggest problem, and the numbers speak for themselves, come from the Federated States of Micronesia, and that's to the south of Guam. But the idea is that, you know, the bigger solution, too, I have often said, tell the U.S. Federal government in Washington, D.C., with their State Department, help these people at the Federated States of Micronesia. One of their islands is notorious for creating the most amount of criminals in Guam, Hawaii, and throughout the United States, quite frankly, the West Coast. Educate them. Guam and the Philippines, we had the benefit of having the Spanish colonial influence for 500 years. They created schools, churches, the Western way of life in these two areas of the world. The FSM has a problem of not having sufficient education, especially from one of their states of Chuuk. And I know that I've spoken to them. I have Chuukese friends myself. But the point is that find the solution to the problem. That's the bigger picture. But of course, I'm not the federal government. We can only try to influence and tell them that these people that are coming out, it's a small island, but it's creating so much criminality. And it's like the American Indian experience in the United States. When a bigger culture, a different culture comes in and they take over a smaller culture or allow them to move and migrate within another culture, you're going to get them pushed into the lower income brackets. And the lower income brackets normally are associated with more criminality. So, you know, that is the solution. Mm-hmm. It's a small part of the problem that the U.S. could easily fix through creating an education system down in the FSM, a better education system.
So, Attorney General, as we talk about the fact that in exchange for a prisoner's release, you are literally just wanting them to leave the country. I mean, but what discussions have you actually had with governments or even community leaders in the countries and territories that really, where are these people going to go or where are they going to be deported back to?
Right. Well, like in the United States, what we're seeing in the mainland, if you're observing it, they send them back to their countries of origin because they're not U.S. citizens. They have passports, and in this case, the majority of them have passports from the Federated States of Micronesia, which is, in our area of the world, Australia, Guam, and the Pacific area. So basically, it's send them back home. They are taken by their governments. The federal, and again, we're working with our U.S. federal government, DHS, ICE. They have a working relationship with the FSM and Chuuk State to receive these people back because they have their passports. You know, it's like a U.S. citizen being taken from Australia and sent back to the United States. Of course, they're going to take them back. That is their right as a citizen. So, yeah, that's how we're approaching it. It's just make a safer Guam, safer United States jurisdiction. We're the tip of the spear, the farthermost U.S. Possession of the United States in Guam to Asia, that is.
Thank you for that, Attorney General. I mean, yeah, again, there has been critique. It's sounding controversial, but I do appreciate that you've come through to answer these questions. We will definitely keep in touch with you, Attorney General, as to how this plays out. But again, we just want to say thank you for your time.
You're very welcome. And just one more point here.
Sure.
You know, the crime victims I speak of, many of the crime victims are their own countrymen on Guam. So when you have these robberies, murders, and family violence incidents, what you name it, a lot of the crime victims are their own non-U.S. citizen family members and members of the community. So, you know, it's actually protecting their own people as well. I don't think that safety has any race, creed, religion, nationality associated with it. When people are hurt in a crime victim, it doesn't matter. So, yeah, that's our focus. But I do realize it creates a controversy.
Yeah, and thank you again for coming through to share with us this morning. But again, we thank you so much, General Attorney.
You're welcome.
That was Guam's Attorney General Douglas Moylan speaking to me there here on Pacific Beat. A WHO and UNDP report is calling for the introduction of free syringes and needles as a way to curb a surge in HIV infections in Fiji. Now, Fiji has recorded more than 1,500 new HIV infections in 2024, with health authorities pointing to intravenous drug use as the key driver in infections. Now, the new report says a scarcity of clean syringes, unsafe practice, and a lack of knowledge about blood safety has seen HIV infection rates surge, with young Itauke or indigenous Fijian men the most affected. Well, for more on this topic, we're joined by Dr. Alipate Vakamondea, President of the Fiji Medical Association. With that, I say, Yandra, Doctor, thank you for joining us.
Yandra, Yandra Vinaka, and Happy New Year to everyone.
Absolutely. Happy New Year, Doctor. Thank you so much for joining us this morning. I must say, you know, I'd like your thoughts on this call for a national needle and syringe program. Like, is this what's needed to curb that growing HIV statistic?
Yeah, well, two things. Number one is the study presents actual evidence from IV drug users that they have actively been sharing. And we also know that the HIV statistics are being pushed by the IV drug users. So this is definitely something that we need to do. We need to get our people to stop sharing their syringes, and that would help hopefully curb the HIV increase.
Mm. And Doctor, I know in Fiji, pharmacies can't actually, you know, provide needles and syringes without a prescription. So I'm just wondering, would you support then the removal of this provision, you know, like this report is actually calling for?
Yeah, so it was interesting that this is not actually something that's legislated. So when the investigators actually went and approached some pharmacists, they said that to support the prevention of IV drug use, they were mandating that prescriptions had to be given for to prescribe the needles and syringes. But what we're trying to do now is to get rid of that and to tell pharmacists, basically, if someone comes in and wants to buy a needle and syringe or something, just go ahead and give it to them, to make it safer.
Mm. And with that, would then having needles and syringe work, would it actually work in the Fijian context? Because, you know, we talk about the communal nature of Fijian society and that stigma, you know, that surrounds drug use. Your thoughts?
Yeah, that's an interesting one. So we know from evidence that it has worked overseas, places like Southeast Asia and things like that. It's made a significant impact on reducing the number of IV drug transmitted HIV. But like you said, our nature here is that in the Pacific is one where we share, like in the, you know, Yangona, we share a bowl of Yangona amongst multiple people. So this could possibly be something that aligns to our culture, but not in a good way. And so one of the things that the government has done is, you hear on the media right now, they are trying to basically sensitize the public and especially IV drug users to not share needles, like share everything else. But this is one thing that we would encourage you not to share.
Yes.
Time will tell whether it makes an impact.
Yeah, and I'm also wondering, Doctor, do you think it like should go further and include injecting rooms, you know, similar to what's in places like here in Australia and New Zealand?
Yeah, I don't know if that's what the study had suggested, but it could possibly be something that that we look at. But at the moment, we're just trying to get the basics right, which is making sure that we have the needle and syringe program running first, and then we could look at value adding and looking at other opportunities to increase the safety of this.
Mm. Okay, well, this is interesting, Doctor, because, you know, around this time, 1 year ago, I think you were on Pacific Beat and even the ABC warning about intravenous drug use and an HIV surge. Yep. And now it's become a government concern. You know, the PM is talking about it. So are you happy that there is now an all sort of government approach to the problem?
Yeah, obviously, this is something that the Fiji Medical Association have been jumping up and down about for a few years now. But yeah, very glad that the government has got involved, and it's multiple sectors that have all come together now. So we're working on not just the needle syringe program, but also trying to address the issues around addicts, so addictions. We've got some donor partners who've also got involved. Koika, they're looking at setting up a drug rehab hospital in Suva, and even with DFAT, they're looking at supporting. They did a consultation looking at setting up a new service specifically targeting drug addicts. So lots of support in this area, and I think we're moving in the right direction.
Mm. And look, talking about the right directions, then do you think from your experience, or even from your members' own experience, do you see HIV cases as stagnating or being reduced? Because, like, I mean, in short, are we in a better situation than last year?
In terms of the numbers, I don't think we are in a better situation. I think from what our members are sharing preliminary, it's still increasing. So we haven't seen that plateau yet. But hopefully in the next couple of months, couple of years, we'll start to see the plateau and then hopefully the decrease. But at this point, we're not seeing that. And there are other issues, like we need to know what the numbers are. At the moment, the ministry keeps referring to that from 2024, which is now a year old. But from what we gather from the ground, it's definitely increased significantly. We haven't plateaued yet.
Mm. Yeah, and as you said earlier, you know, this is a whole thing where it's a bit of a wait and see to see whether it works.
Yeah.
But again, apart from free needles and syringes, Doctor, what can health authorities do to actually combat the surge in HIV infections?
Yeah, so I think this. They're doing all they can at the moment. And like I said, they're being supported significantly. But we need to think a bit broader than health. This issue has been brought around because of drugs. And I noticed that it now seems to be being discovered in other parts of the Pacific, like Samoa. And that is a serious issue. And so in the same line as that, we're getting lots of donor partners, other countries to come and assist Fiji in health. We also are calling for donor partners to start assisting to police the Pacific, because we are basically the dumping ground for these hard drugs before they actually go to their intended location, which is unfortunately Australia and New Zealand. So we're calling on development partners, other countries to come and assist the Pacific, not just in health, but in protecting our borders and keeping these drugs out of the Pacific, because this is the real cause of these issues that we are currently facing.
And that's it. Coming back to this WHO and UNDP report, it mentioned that young Itauke or Fijian men are the most affected by the surge in HIV numbers. Doctor, why do you think it's had such a hard hit on your young Fijian men?
Yeah, I guess it's the risky behavior that young Fijian men, Itauke men, are used to. It's their behavior that makes them that predisposes them to being part of the high risk population. But what we've seen now is that it's now starting to spill into not just IV drug users, but it's now becoming sexually transmitted. There's increased mother to child transmission rates and things like that. So I think it's particularly hitting us, the Itauke male, quite significantly because of their behavior.
Doctor, that's all the time that we have for today, but as always, appreciate you coming on and sharing your thoughts on the call for this National Syringe and Needles Program. Vinaka.
Vinaka Vakalevu.
That was the President of the Fiji Medical Association, Dr. Alibate Vakamundea.
Join Natasha Metin for Sisters Let's Talk, a program that explores issues that are in the hearts and minds of Pacific women.
I cried because, sharing about the challenges that I face on a day-to-day basis. As a 15-year-old, took a really big toll on me.
Mm-hmm.
It took me out of my comfort zone.
Sisters Let's Talk, Thursday mornings at 9 a.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia or wherever you get your podcasts.
Now, if you've just joined us, appreciate the company. I'm your host, Aggie Dubol, and this is Pacific Beat. Just giving you a quick recap of what's been on the show so far. We spoke to Guam's Attorney General on why he's approved such a controversial billboard campaign to purge prisoners so they don't come back to his country. And you would have just heard whether a free needle and syringe program will curb the HIV cases in Fiji. Still to come, I catch up with Kiwi Samoan comedian Tor Finga. But up next, it's your news wrap here on Pacific Beat.
Hold the front page!
Whakalavalahi atu and welcome back to Pacific Beat. My goodness, it's been a while since I've done a news wrap, but we're back for 2026. And joining me in the studio is producer Whenau Whonua. With that, I say fair, fair. Happy New Year's, bro.
So, Ben, happy New Year's to everyone. Yes.
Absolutely. You got some good plans for this year?
I haven't even thought about it.
I know, we're only 5 days into it, so it's all right, don't worry. Look, we are back with our news wrap. Of course, that means we head around the region with the latest headlines. Whenau, you've brought us the story about US travel restrictions, then now enforced for Tongans. Elaborate a little bit more on this.
The new US travel restrictions announced by Trump have officially commenced in force since New Year's Day, 1st of January. So under the new restrictions, visa issuance for short-term visits, tourism and business purposes have been suspended and severely limited for those who are eligible to enter the permanent Tongans with permanent U.S. residency. The new restrictions are the result of a presidential proclamation 10998. And according to this proclamation, the new regulations would, quote, protect the security of the United States. The White House has stated that the regulations are country-specific, and they've cited a relatively high overstaying rate for Tongans visiting the U.S., so hinting that the high overstaying rate is the reason for Tonga being put on this blacklist. According to the official figures, America's Tongan diaspora numbers at least 78,000.
Wow.
And many of the Tongan Americans have non-citizen parents. So it will affect the ability, of course, for family to visit the United States. There has been no official Tongan response to the new U.S. restrictions of yet. The new Prime Minister, Lord Whakapuanua, is expected to front media at some point, so we expect a comment from him on this.
Okay, yeah, we will wait and see on that. There's a new multi-million-dollar hotel that's been unveiled in the Solomon Islands. Hearing reports that it's an impressive site in Honiara, right?
Yes, that's what we've heard. It's called the Xiao Henderson Hotel. It's located opposite Honiara International Airport, east of Honiara. The four-floor hotel offers 142 rooms. Solomon Islands Deputy Prime Minister Frederick Kologeto officiated the grand opening of the hotel over the weekend. Two Chinese construction companies built the hotel over the space of the year, and it had the financial support of ANZ Bank. In his speech, Deputy Secretary for the Ministry of Culture and Tourism, Philip Sukibuka, said that this new hotel raised the standard of accommodation and services in the country, and says that it will hopefully make a big boost to the tourism industry in the Solomon Islands.
Yeah, I definitely think so. Absolutely. Well, now let's look into a study into human migrations across the Pacific, because they say the genomes of pigs provides insight into timing of the first voyages in the region. This sounds interesting.
Yes, it is interesting. The study was conducted by the American Association for the Advancement of Science and published the paper last week. And according to this study, pigs across the Pacific traced their ancestry to Southeast Asian domestic pigs who accompanied early Austronesian people who island hopped across the region. But the study says genetic evidence found in the pigs finds that the livestock arrived to the Pacific region more than 4,000 years ago.
Wow.
That predates major Austronesian migrations, the Polynesian migration in particular. So it suggests successive human migrations across the region rather than one major migration. And it found that pigs throughout the region carry a unique Pacific clade genetic signature. So developed an ice, the pigs developed this genetic signature in as a result of being in isolation for so long. But the introduction of European pigs to the region has greatly diversified the genomes of these pigs. But yeah, they're common. They have a common Southeast Asian ancestor, believed to originate in places like Borneo and Sulawesi in Indonesia.
There we go. That is really fascinating.
Yes, yes.
European pigs versus Tongan pigs. Who yes. would win in a fight?
I don't know. But they both taste good, so.
That's true. Absolutely. Some crackling would be good right now. Whenua, as always, we really appreciate you bringing us the headlines from across the Pacific. That's your news wrap here on Pacific Beat. Now to the arts. He is one of Pacific's most loved comedians. Originally one half of the iconic Laughing Samoans, to now leading a successful solo career. Tō Whenua Whepuliai. He has spent years turning everyday Pacific life into comedy gold. I got to speak with Tō Whenua earlier about the stories behind his humour, his journey, and what fans can expect from his brand new live show heading here to Australia. It's Shush Your Mouth.
You know, you've become like one of the most recognizable comedic voices, not just in the Pacific, I think like across the world. For you, does that even faze you at all?
No, I've never thought of anything like that. I just enjoy what I do. Even if only five people like that, I just love putting smiles on people's faces, realizing what my purpose in life was in terms of comedy and making people laugh. It's been a pleasure every morning to be able to wake up and do what I do. It doesn't feel like work, so yeah, it doesn't faze me in terms of, I don't think of it like that.
What initially actually drew you to comedy?
Probably the earliest memories is when Mum and Dad would make me perform in front of our family, you know, when we have kōngai or family gatherings at home. I really used to love breakdancing back in the days, you know, especially being born in the mid-70s and, breakdancing and things like that. So I used to dance and I used to love the reaction, you know, they wanted more, they were happy and seeing the smiles on their faces. So, you know, from that to doing White Sunday in church, you know, doing productions with our junior youth group, you know, Sunday school. I think at an early age, I realized, you know, hey, I'm pretty good at doing this thing of performing. And you know, it wasn't until 2003 when we did our first Laughing Samoan show, or Laughing with Samoans, where it was the first time I ever did it in public in terms of people were paying tickets. Because I'm always performing in front of family, you know, they're always going to laugh. So even if you're really bad, they're like, oh, just laugh, just to make them feel good. So I'd never been so nervous before doing a public show. And then when I cracked my first joke, I heard the first sound of laughter. It felt like time had froze. And it was sort of like there. That is when I had a bit of a light bulb moment. And it felt like, you know, this is my purpose in life. This is what I want to do. Then the rest is history.
How much of your upbringing has sort of shaped like the characters or the, you know, the stories that you bring to the stage?
It's everything. My upbringing is everything. My family is everything. All the characters, you know, it's a mix of my real aunties and uncles, life experiences. And that's why all the comedy I do is about being a Samoan, you know, through the lens of a Samoan, you know, being born in New Zealand. I didn't talk about anything else but my life growing up. So I never run out of material. As long as I have family, I never run out of material.
How then do you, like, balance the humour with respect, you know, when you are drawing from your culture, you know, from your faith, even your family?
Yeah, I think it is too. But also being raised as Samoan, you know, you need to understand the wā, the sacred space between how far you can push certain things. You push it to a stage where then you leave it up to their imagination. You know, it's being Samoan, whānau'alo is one of the key things, you know, in our culture, our manu. So, you know, you do stuff, you push the envelope, but with that respect in mind. When I do my stuff, I have to always imagine my parents being there and watching it and being proud of it. If they're not, then I know that maybe I'm going too far, or, you know, maybe I need to change my career or something like that.
Do you ever test your jokes on your family, like, you know, with your wife and the kids? Or?
Yeah, no. That's why it's cool to have family gatherings, you know, like lovers and kōngai. That's where you test it out. I never test my stuff on my wife. She doesn't laugh at anything that I do. You know, I know she's laughing deep down inside. My kids are good. You know, they're good to try stuff on, but with our family. That's where you can test that out. And
let's sort of switch it up then, Zofinger, because, you know, comedy has actually changed a lot because of, you know, things like social media. How much does that sort of influence your work now?
I mean, you probably see, I don't really do that content stuff. I think, I don't know whether it's because I'm old school or just not really up to date with all the technology and stuff. Mm. But, some of these content creators, you know, they're funny, you know, they make me laugh and stuff. But I thrive on that live audience interaction. Mm. I just love being on stage because it's always going to be a different show. The things that happen on the day or people coming in. And I'm not saying I'm against it or won't try it. Maybe later if I have time or maybe one. My kids might want to do some stuff together, but yeah, I just really enjoy the live action and live audience.
If you were not a comedian, what would you be doing?
I probably would have been a teacher, eh? You know, I love talking, sharing stories. I love teaching. I always wanted to be a policeman when I was a young kid. Wow. But then, you know, they got all that fitness stuff. Maybe if they gave me a dog, I'll be one of those policemen with a dog. And then I'll just let the dog do all the running and chasing. And I'll just wait over at the drive-thru.
Wow. Again, you're going to be here in Australia. Again, what can audiences expect from your new Shush Your Mouth show?
Yeah, I guess they can expect, for people who haven't seen me in a while, especially doing stand-up by myself, it's going to be a great show, plenty of stories. But this one is more like midlife crisis thing, me being in my 50s now, you know, I'm 51 now, so it's talking about what it's like for me being a father as a son more, with my kids growing up, you know, and also with my health journey, you know, being married, all those sort of things. And also, you know, the characters will come in and out. I mean, one classic part that I talk about, my health journey, for example, this morning I was really happy when I went to weigh myself, because trying to lose weight and that. But I don't know if you've noticed, but I lost my scales. Yeah, so I couldn't weigh myself. But it's going to be a fun time. You know, if you know me, you're going to have a great time and great for the whole family, so you can bring your kids. Don't worry about babysitter, just bring them. And, you know, you can bring your girlfriend, your wife as well, and the one on the side. Anyone, just bring everyone and anyone. And looking forward to coming over to Australia.
And that is proud Kiwi Samoan comedian Tōwhinga Whepuriai. Now look out for a show, Shush Your Mouth. It's touring from February 2026 across Australia. And that literally brings us to the end of Pacific Beat. Looking back at one of our main stories, a WHO report is calling for the introduction of free syringes to help curb a surge in HIV infections in Fiji. It has the support of the Fiji Medical Association president.
This is definitely something that we need to do. We need to get our people to stop sharing their syringes, and that would help hopefully curb the HIV increase.
Now, we'll be back at the same time at 6 a.m. PNG time tomorrow. You can hear us this afternoon at 5 p.m. PNG also. Now, stay tuned. Up next, it is your news. And then coming up after that, it's Nisha Daily. This is Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific.